Some of us grew up with the music of the Beatles. Others of us heard it over and over, either on the radio or when our parents played it at home on LPs that grew only scratchier with age. Then came the glorious age of CDs, and now everything streams. Still, when it comes to some Beatles experiences, such as the 1968 animated movie Yellow Submarine, the potential to experience something new is ever present. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And on this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, and I will take part in this, a 50th anniversary screening of Yellow Submarine before a live audience. Let us know you're here, audience. We're here at the historic Bing Crosby Theater. So don't touch that dial, because another Beatlemania-themed Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
When you hear us say, listener-supported public radio, what are we really saying? Public radio is shorthand for thought-provoking, well-crafted, stimulating programs. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for those programs. And not only the programs, but the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything it takes to bring you those programs. So here's a very large thank you to you, the listener, in listener-supported public radio.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga Law School.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, that show that usually finds the three of us, plus our multi-talented producer, the one and only Jim Tevenin, working out of a quiet Spokane Public Radio recording studio. On occasion, however, the SPR powers that be force us out into the open. And that's why we're here tonight, at the historic Bing Crosby Theater in downtown Spokane, appearing before a live audience. That's your cue to make noise, folks. The occasion is a special 50th anniversary screening of Yellow Submarine, the 1968 animated movie that features some 15 songs by the famous Fab Four, otherwise known as the Beatles. We've done live shows about the Beatles before, 4 years ago, in fact, with the 50th anniversary screening of Richard Lester's 1964 movie, A Hard Day's Night. SPR, if you hadn't noticed, is big on anniversaries. But Yellow Submarine clearly is a submersible of a whole different color. Let's begin with a few notes about how the movie even came about, who directed it, and what both the initial reaction was and what today's critics have to say about it. Why don't you start us off, MP?
I think I was given the task of presenting the factoids because I'm not an official critic, so I'm going to provide you with a little timeline.
You're only on National Public Radio. I think you're at this point.
So in 1964, A Hard Day's Night was released, and at that time, the Beatles had signed a three-picture contract with United Artists, which resulted in A Hard Day's Night and Help, and each of those films was directed by Richard Lester. But they hated the second film. They did not like Help, and they were really reluctant to do a third show. In 1965, there was a relatively short-lived Beatles television series. Well, it actually ran for 4 years, so I guess that's significant compared to some of the 9-episode series we see today.
I think there were 39 episodes in the last two seasons, they were almost all reruns, but
right.
Still.
But the Beatles didn't like that either, and Brian Epstein, their manager at the time, hated the series even more. Then finally in 1966, Yellow Submarine, the song, was released, and it rose to number one in Britain, and it got up to a number two ranking in the U.S. And I think that the producer, ultimately, of the film knew that the Beatles did not want to do another live show. So he approached Brian Epstein and said, hey, there's some interest in doing an animated version of something that would involve the Beatles, focusing on the song specifically. these stories are always a little apocryphal because now we're hearing that maybe Epstein approached
Brodax.
Right, but that always happens when something turns out well, then you want to take credit for it. But I think that Epstein was really picky about the script, and so that held things up for a time period. This is also 1966. This is my little tabloid portion of the broadcast. That's the year that John Lennon first encountered Yoko Ono at her art exhibit in London. And so finally, the script was approved, and in 1967, there was $1 million budget that was allocated for this, and the movie had to be delivered in 11 months.
Unheard of.
Yeah, for an animated film at this particular time, that was an unheard of. And so George Dunning, who's a Canadian animator, worked with 250 different folks to bring this to fruition. And it premiered in 1968, and the rest is history, as we say. It was re-released in 1999. Additional songs were added, and I think both Nathan and Dan will talk a little bit more about how that worked. And now here we are in 2018 for the 50th anniversary. Just so you know that it was released in theaters in the U.S. on July 13th, I believe, or July 8th.
July 8th.
It was released in Ireland and the U.K. or in Great Britain. So for the past month, it's been screening on Amazon Prime. But why are you here tonight? Because seeing this film on the big screen, I think, is a must. So we hope that you will agree when we conclude.
So we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the people who are involved. Just like a show like this, a public radio station can't run without lots of people behind the scenes. Some of the people who worked on this, let's begin with Al Brodax, the producer. He was a Broadway producer and a television writer-producer, and he was hired by King Features in 1960 to run its new motion picture and television division. And he produced many, many cartoons, 200 of the old Popeye cartoons, and he collaborated with Bob Kane, the creator of Batman, on the animated spy spoof Cool McCool. He did other things like Crazy Cat, Beetle Bailey, Snuffy Smith, and then in 1965, he began producing the Beatles series, which is how he got in contact with the Beatles and with Brian Epstein. And he knew that they didn't want to do a third movie, and so the story goes, this is how he told it. He went to Epstein, and in a meeting with them and the four guys, he said, quote, "I told them that I could do the work and they could all go off and see the Maharishi or whatever they wanted to do. Everybody would be happy if they just signed here." Unquote. Can you imagine believing any agent, any producer would say something like that?
I also heard a quote from George Harrison who said his favorite thing about this movie was that he really didn't have to do anything at all. That was his favorite thing about it.
So some of the other people who have to be mentioned are the visual effects director, Charles Jenkins, and he's the guy who apparently recommended the guy who really, really makes the movie, and that's Heinz Edelman, who is a Czech-born illustrator. He's responsible for all the psychedelic additions. He created Boob, who becomes the Nowhere Man. There's a sequence in there in which there's a countdown from 61 seconds, I think, or from 1 to 61. I can't remember now. Have I ever seen this movie?
64, not, they said. Yeah.
There you go, 64.
Okay.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Okay. Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, I'm 6 years older than that, so I can be excused for a senior moment.
Sure. You get one.
Dude, my whole life is a senior moment anymore. In an interview I found on YouTube, Edelman claimed that he came up with a caricature of the individual Beatles by just looking at the covers of the albums, and he says he's the one who suggested that the movie be set up in these sequences so that nothing would go on too long, so anybody would get bored all the way up till the end. So the one person that I usually like to talk about when it comes to movies is the director. The director was George Dunning. And Dunning was a guy who was a wunderkind in Canada. He was born in 1920, and he worked for the National Film Board, went to New York, worked for a little show called Gerald McBoing Boing. Does anybody remember Gerald McBoing?
Yeah,
he worked for that. And then he went to London and started his own company called TVC London. And it was there that he contracted with Brodax and King Features to do the Beatles television series. And he made his own films too. He got a BAFTA, British Academy Award, for a little film he made in 1962 called The Apple. And then another film in that same year called The Flying Man, both of which are completely different movies from this. But like all the people who worked on this movie, Yellow Submarine, he tried to capture the spirit of the times, and the British Film Institute claims that he conceived and took personal charge of the Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds sequence, among other things. So, Nathan, what is it that you have to tell us?
Well, I wanted to talk about the critical reception of the movie at the time, because this was the third Beatles feature, and A Hard Day's Night was actually very well received at the time. I think even the New York Times, Bosley Crowther, who I always picture as a guy with like a monocle and shaking his fist at kids, even he liked A Hard Day's Night.
Help was young whippersnapper.
Yeah, right, exactly like that. And Help was not as well received, but I wanted to check and see what critics at the time thought of Yellow Submarine, and it turns out they actually liked it quite a bit. I found Roger Ebert's review from 1968. I believe it was his second year as a film critic. I think he was younger than I am now at the time. And he admitted in his review that although Yellow Submarine wasn't as entertaining as A Hard Day's Night was, he did call it, quote, the most original and inventive feature-length animated cartoon, since the days when Walt Disney was still thinking up innovations. Variety also wrote about it in their typically kind of clipped, terse prose. They said, it remains deliberately corny at times and never ventures out of its depth in flirtations with time, space, and philosophy. Unlike Disney, the film makes no concession to sentiment, which I think is a little bit unfair, but also a good thing, right? And then Renata Adler in the New York Times was quite high on it, and she said, it captured the spirit and conventions of the Sunday comic strip, the rhythm of movie direction by George Dunning, who Dan mentioned earlier, and the rhythms of music are meant for each other, full of enfolded meanings, jokes, puns, some of them Lennon infantile, none of them aggressive, pretentious, or self-indulgent, that would delight a child or a head or anybody who loves and admires the Beatles. Why don't you explain what a head is?
Isn't that a movie that the...
The monkeys? Yeah.
Yeah.
Dan was a head in the late 1960s. Say that. And the movie was re-released in 1999 and got a re-review from Roger Ebert, who actually put it in his collection of great movies at the time, and he actually bumped up his original star rating from 3.5 to 4 stars. This is what he said on the films. I guess it would be its 31st anniversary. He said, perhaps because the Beatles were considered such a draw, perhaps because the songs were counted on to sell the film, there was no agenda to dumb down the material or hard sell the story. Instead of contrived urgency, there's unpressured whimsy, and the movie exists as pure charm expressed in fantastical imagery. I think it's expression in fantastical imagery there. Yellow Submarine was also embraced as a head movie, leading to an observation attributed to Ken Kesey. They say it looks better when you're stoned, but that's true of all movies. That's the best review this movie got, I think.
That's what happens when you're a movie critic and a head.
Right.
And we've just that fast reached halfway, so we need to take a break. Well, let me remind you that this is Movies 101. And before we go, remember that you can access both podcasts of Movies 101 and the individual reviews that Nathan and I write by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to continue our discussion of the 1968 animated movie Yellow Submarine. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back with this special edition of Movies 101, taped before a live audience. Let's hear it again, folks.
Yeah.
The occasion is a special 10th anniversary screening of Yellow Submarine at the historic Bing Crosby Theater. I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbender, I warbled on. Wait a minute, let me own that. I warbled on. The other two provided us with illuminating and intelligent commentary. Anyway, we talked about the making of the movie. Let's continue in the same vein. Nathan, this might sound a bit heretical, but why don't you talk about Yellow Submarine as a movie and not just a compilation of Beatles songs?
Okay, I would be happy to. Before I do that, though, this is something I always like to do. I'm curious, just by applause, how many people here in the packed Bing Crosby Theater have never seen Yellow Submarine before? This is your first time.
Yeah.
Okay. How many of you saw it when it originally came out in 1968? Of that second group, how many of you were not stoned out of your gourds when you saw it in 1968?
Yeah, that's pretty notable.
Well, they must have been children then. I think what is interesting about Yellow Submarine is that it is, I'm going to use a term that really didn't exist when it came out, which is jukebox musical, which I think puts people's teeth on edge, but that's sort of what it is. Now, that's a term that's used for movies where they take, or plays, where they take songs from a certain artist or era and sort of fashion a narrative around it. So you think Jersey Boys or Mamma Mia or Rock of Ages. In terms of films, Singin' in the Rain is an early example of the jukebox musical. They took all these songs that were in the MGM vault and sort of fashioned a narrative around it. And the Beatles music was used again in Across the Universe about 10 years ago, which just got re-released. So this is kind of a jukebox musical in a way. They took all these songs that the Beatles had already recorded, a couple of new songs, and sort of kind of shoehorned them into a very thin story. The kind of story that I think would have been on the Beatles cartoon. I mean, it's not exactly substantial. And so it's kind of in the nature of the jukebox musical to have the songs come before the narrative. And I think for those of you that have never seen this, you're not going to need a notebook to follow along with the plot of Yellow Submarine. It's really just an excuse to hear the music and have these psychedelic visuals along with it. So it's a good thing that in this case they were working with some of the best pop songs ever recorded. So you really don't mind that it is kind of just a series of sketches. And not true, somebody said, oh, someone's mad at me already.
It might be your mom.
Join the club.
Yeah, everyone's mad at me, get in line. What I find really interesting, though, about this movie is that a lot of the songs get their own standalone, almost music videos, where the filmmakers will adopt an entirely different style of animation to go with that song. So you've got Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, which you mentioned earlier, which has this amazing rotoscoping, which is where they take actual video or film footage and animate over it. It was an early use of that. You've got the Eleanor Rigby sequence, which is probably my favorite, which is right near the beginning of the movie where they use animated photographs. And if you pay attention, a lot of the people in that sequence are actually the animators that worked on the film. They made their own cameos in that sequence. Yeah. And then the George Harrison song, Only a Northern Song, which I think is a very underrated Harrison song, gets these visualized sonic frequencies. So it's constantly changing around as the Beatles are hopping around from one plane to get to Pepperland, which is essentially the plot here. So this is really just kind of a delivery system for songs accompanied by visuals that are often totally insane. And so I think in that sense, it really has more in common with something like Fantasia, the Disney film, than it does, say, you know, more contemporary animated films. And I don't think they really make mass market animated films like Yellow Submarine anymore. I mean, I think there are a lot of foreign or indie animators that have made more cerebral things, unless I'm forgetting about something. You don't see anything like
even
this.
Even the cartoon anymore. Shows that are influenced by this, Futurama, other ones,
right.
They have distinct little storylines.
Right.
You know? This one, you could write the story in 25 words or less.
Right.
You could describe the plot. And right. The rest of it is, holy moly.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Well, okay, but don't you think there's a difference between the story and the plot? Because I think there is a story, and it's told visually. I don't know how much of a plot there really is. I mean, one of the interesting things is looking back at this. We have all different kinds of creatures, except not a whole lot of female creatures throughout, and not a whole lot of female
we don't know
participants
about Glove.
In the program.
Is Glove a man or a woman? I don't know.
And, you know, who knows? But, yeah, I thought that was intriguing. Yeah.
I also want to say that a lack of a plot is not inherently a bad thing. In fact, some of my favorite movies have no plot at all. But, you know, it's really about the visuals. It's allowing the music and the visuals to just kind of take you over. So.
You know, one of the things that I found interesting is that there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people credited with writing this thing. Of course, you can take Lennon and McCartney right off it. They wrote Yellow Submarine, the song, and so they're credited in the screenplay. But Lee Minoff was a guy who was a playwright in New York, and he was hired to write the screenplay. They flew him to London, and he wanted to go back home, but Brodak said, no, we got to make this deal. You got to write the script in one night. He wrote it in one night. That's what he claimed, which doesn't, 25 words, that's no problem. But also a guy named Jack Mendelsohn, who's a guy who'd worked on everything from Roan and Martin's Laugh-In to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Eric Siegel, the love story guy, wrote it.
This could be an apocryphal story, but supposedly Joseph Heller of Catch-22 wrote a treatment for this early on in the process.
And Brian Epstein.
Go figure. Right.
He hated it. So, and then finally, Roger McGough, who's an English poet, he's the one who took the script and added all the puns in and gave it the Liverpool rhythms that the characters, none of whom are the Beatles, by the way, they're actors, but like a guy named Peter Angelis said that he talked to the Beatles, and every one of the Beatles liked all the other guys but hated his own individual character.
Funny how that works.
Yeah. Have we gotten to the point where we were going to try to pick our favorite Beatles album?
Yeah, let's do it.
Because last time when we did The Hard Day's Night, we all had to pick our favorite Beatle, and of course I was correct. I picked George. You picked...
John,
and you picked?
John.
Yeah, well, you know, Leah and I were
correct. I thought we picked our favorite song the last time.
We did that too. We did that too.
Last time?
Yeah,
well,
I don't remember what I
picked. Our favorite Beatle.
Yes, we did. So we should pick our favorite album now. I think that's what we're going to do.
I think so. First of all, let me begin by saying George Martin, here was a quote on his favorite Beatle album. I've got quite a few favorite Beatles albums. I like Revolver very much, and I like Rubber Soul very much, but I'm very fond of Abbey Road, probably because it's the last album we made, and we kind of knew that. So, I would go with Rubber Soul.
Okay. You want to go next?
Well, that's what I was going to pick. We didn't talk about this ahead of time.
No, we wanted to spring it on you.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Okay, I'll go with Abbey Road.
Okay, Nathan, you go next.
Okay, well, I wrote like a big long preamble. I didn't realize that we were just going to kind of go off. I think it's interesting that... The Beatles kind of created the basic idea of the concept album. I mean, there are arguments for and against that. But Sgt. Pepper's was sort of their most complete, you know, artistic statement.
Then I'll choose that one.
Okay, hers is Sgt. Pepper's. I find it interesting that almost immediately thereafter, they completely deconstructed that, which with my pick for favorite, which is the White Album from 1968. And unlike Sgt. Pepper or even Abbey Road, which is really a perfect album, I love the fact that the White Album is very imperfect. It's a total mess. It has no through line. It sounds like a band ripping apart at the seams as you're listening to it. And that's what I love about it. People say that it has filler, and I like all the filler. I like, and it's, you know, it's not even filler. I'm going to say it.
Your career is filler, is it not?
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Sorry.
This is our last
there
episode,
we go.
Folks.
There we go.
Just like the Beatles, we secretly hate each other.
You should hear how it goes when we're in private. Look, and so, look, we've come to the end here, so we did pick our favorite.
Yeah.
And this ends a special edition of Movies 101 devoted entirely to the 1968 animated movie Yellow Submarine. I'm your host, Dan Webster, and I owe a great debt not only to my talented co-hosts, Nathan Weinbender and Mary Pat Truthart, but also to our skilled partner in crime, Jim Tevenin, who both produces and engineers the show. Even more so, we are all in great debt to you, our live audience. Cheers, cheers, cheers. And we invite both you and our listeners back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again do our best to point out great cinema wherever we can find it. Until then, remember these words from Beatles producer George Martin. because there wasn't a rock and roll precedent, the Beatles, when they came, turned everything upside down and made a revolution. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.